Our next speaker is Dr. Jim Howe. He's going to talk about surgical strategies for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors.
Thank you. I have nothing to disclose. Okay, so we're just going to run through what we do with PNETs, and I'll just abbreviate them PNETs. And this just shows a picture of a PNET in the body of the pancreas, and it's important to think about some of the relationships anatomically. You have the celiac axis, the SMV, the splenic vein, and the IMV, which in these procedures all need to be taken into account. This just shows a picture of intraoperatively of the normal pancreas seen on the left, the stomach above, and then this is a neuroendocrine tumor here. This is a picture you've seen twice today already. You're going to see it one more time. And this just talks about the increasing incidence of PNETs. They used to be in 1973 about 2 per million, and now it's up to 8 per million, so a fourfold increase. And SBNETs have increased sixfold, as Xavier mentioned. So you're going to be seeing these more and more in your practice. And probably the best explanation for this increased incidence is the fact that everybody gets a CAT scan who comes to the emergency room for some kind of abdominal complaint, and they think we're picking these up more and more. So some general facts about PNETs. The mean age is 58.5 years. 55% of patients who get them are male. The ethnic distribution is similar to that of the normal population in the United States. And about 11% present with localized disease, 21% with regional nodal disease, and about 60% with distant metastases. About 90% are non-functional, and we'll talk about that more in a little bit. Now, with respect to survival, these are from SEER data between 1973 and 2000. The five-year overall survival of all comers with PNETs in the United States was 33% five-year survival, or a median of 28 months. If they're functional, they do a little bit better with a five-year survival of 47.6%, 54-month median survival. And if they're non-functional, then that reduces to about 31% five-year survival and 26 months median survival. If the tumors are localized, about 62% will live 5 years or more. And if they're metastatic, then that drops to about 20%. So that's kind of the landscape of how people do in the U.S. population. This is just a graph that shows the difference between functional up top and non-functional tumors, again, with an advantage with functional tumors. And perhaps this is because the diagnosis comes earlier because of the symptoms. Now, one thing to consider anytime you're seeing a patient with a PNET is whether this could be a familial situation or a sporadic situation. And the familial situation is a lot more complicated because these tumors are multifocal and the strategies for taking them out are going to be different. The most common conditions you're going to see predisposing to familial PNETs is MEN1, where, people get pituitary lesions, parathyroid lesions, and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Probably the second most common is von Hippel-Lindau, where people get not only pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, but they also get cysts of the pancreas. And reviewing the MRIs or CTs can be very complex to figure out what's what. These patients also get renal cell carcinomas, pheochromocytomas, and hemangioblastomas of the cerebellum and the spinal cord. If we look at, there are really four syndromes, and this gives the risk of developing a PNET. So MEN1, it's anywhere from 30 to 80%. For VHL, it's about 10 to 20%. For neurofibromatosis, which is another condition that predisposes to these tumors, it's 10%. And tuberous sclerosis, it's about 1%. And again, it's just important to recognize this if you see a patient and there's a family history, because it's going to be a little more complicated to figure out the management. Now, the other thing that's important to assess is whether these tumors are functional or non-functional. Functional means it makes an elevated level of hormone and causes a clinical syndrome. And as we said before, about 90% of patients are non-functional, although that number may be a little bit lower than that. It might be more in the 70 to 90% range, because in these national databases, I'm not sure how well we capture hormonal secretion. So they can make a lot of things. Like I said, if it makes nothing, it's non-functional. If it makes insulin, it's an insulinoma. They can make gastrin, VIP, glucagon, somatostatin, And then pancreatic polypeptide is considered a non-functional type of hormone. It doesn't cause a lot of symptoms, and it's a pretty good marker for non-functional tumors. So this is a good marker to test for. Now, as far as making the diagnosis, you know, patients may have symptoms. So again, if they have an insulinoma, they're going to have hypoglycemia. If they have a gastrinoma, they're going to have ulcers. But a lot of the non-functional patients might just have vague abdominal pain, and they get a CT scan, and that shows a pancreatic mass. And on imaging, these pancreatic masses, if it's a good quality CT scan with an arterial phase, it's going to enhance, which is different from an adenocarcinoma, which is tends to be a little bit more hypodense. If you see one of these lesions, doing biochemical testing for any of these markers, including pancreatic polypeptide, is maybe indicated, although I wouldn't say that everybody gets all those gastrin somatostatin sent, but clearly if they have any symptoms related to ulcer disease or insulin and hypoglycemia, those should be tested as well. But you're going to make the tissue diagnosis by doing an endoscopic ultrasound. That's how most of our patients get diagnosed. You can also do a CT-guided biopsy of the pancreatic mass, or if they present with liver metastases, they may have a pancreatic biopsy or a liver biopsy that shows a neuroendocrine tumor with an enhancing lesion in the pancreas. You can put two and two together that that's the primary site. Now, there's a lot of controversy of when to resect PNETs. And clearly, there's not a lot of controversy if the lesion is making a hormone, if it's making insulin and people are passing out, then it needs to come out. So really, any of the functional lesions, VIP and somatostatin, they cause a horrible diarrhea, they really should come out. On the other hand, if it's non-functional, people generally accept the threshold of about 2 centimeters as being the size at which the risk of nodal and liver metastases is high enough to warrant taking it out. And at 2 centimeters, the risk of nodal metastases is about 20% and of liver metastases about 10. Now, if it's less than 1 centimeter, then a lot of these people, you know, who had an incidentally detected lesion may have remained that same size for a very long time. So those patients perhaps should be observed rather than having resection if it's not making anything. Now, the real controversy is if it's 1 to 2 centimeters, then what do we do? If your patient arrives to the clinic in a wheelchair, I would submit that maybe you don't resect it. But if they're a young, vigorous person and you're going to have to follow it for decades, then that's a patient you might want to resect in. So there's kind of a spectrum in that 1 to 2 centimeter range. And it's really not worked out. So that has to be really depending on the situation of the individual patient. Now, in patients with MEN1, we usually wait till the lesion's over 2 centimeters, and in VHL, about 3 centimeters, and that's because of the increased complexity. It's sort of a balancing act between trying not to develop liver or nodal metastases and the fact that when you get in there, it's not going to be just that 2-centimeter tumor. There are going to be 5 other 6 or 8-millimeter tumors that you're going to have to kind of figure out how to deal with. So the treatment options include enucleation, distal pancreatectomy, pancreatic duodenectomy, and now a lot of people are doing laparoscopic distals and even laparoscopic Whipple procedures. Enucleation can be a fairly simple procedure, and this is best done in small lesions and especially insulinomas, which have a much lower incidence of distant metastasis. And you can basically just shell the lesion out. Now, the pancreas bleeds a lot, so you need to use cautery and often need to oversew small arteries. But it's a pretty effective way of removing the tumor with just a little rim of normal tissue. But you really shouldn't do it if it's very close to the duct, because there's a good chance you'll get a duct leak. This is an example of an enucleation of a larger lesion that we did. And this was a tumor that was kind of hanging off the top of the pancreas, but it was about a 2 to 3 centimeter lesion. Again, a little bit bigger than you would normally enucleate, but you can kind of see that we've been able with an energy device to just come across the pancreas tumor interface, actually with about a centimeter margin. And then we've also cleaned off the hepatic artery and splenic artery lymph nodes. And here's the SMV in the splenic vein. So in a larger lesion like that, if you're going to enucleate, doing a nodal dissection would probably make sense. But again, since this was far away from the duct, we didn't need to do, say, like a central pancreatectomy. This is just what a PNET looks like under the microscope. This is a low power view, and on higher power, you can see a normal islet over here, and this is what the tumor looks like. Now, what of the lesions in the body or tail? And this is an example of a body or tail lesion. And these are commonly associated with splenic vein thrombosis and a lot of gastric varices. So most of these patients are going to require splenectomy in addition to the distal pancreatectomy. This just shows one such tumor in the body of the pancreas here. Here's a splenic artery that's been looped. The spleen has been mobilized, and we're going to divide the pancreas right here. This just shows division of the pancreas, division of the splenic artery and splenic vein, and the IMV will have to be divided as well. And what it looks like in situ is here's the edge of the pancreas, here's the edge of the splenic vein, and the edge of the splenic artery. And then the specimen will look something like this with the tumor here, the spleen over here, and a lot of the lymph nodes are going to be along the splenic artery, and then we'll also commonly take the hepatic artery nodes as well. And here's the margin of resection. Now, if it's in the head, it gets a little more complicated. This is a patient with a very large pancreatic head lesion with a nodal metastasis. You can see the duodenum being pushed over here. Coronal view, again, shows a duodenum, primary, a large node. And here you can actually see thrombus in the splenic, the SMV. So this patient's going to require pancreatic duodenectomy with the vein resection. And as you all know, pancreatic duodenectomy, you just divide the neck of the pancreas over the SMV after cocarization and entry into the lesser sac. You're going to remove the head with the duodenum and the bile duct. Your specimen is going to look like this. And then you're going to have to do reconstruction of your pancreatic duct and your bile duct, which is going to be a pancreatic anastomosis, a biliary anastomosis, and either a gastrojejunostomy or a duodenojejunostomy, depending on whether you're doing a pylorus sparing or not. The thing about a Whipple procedure is it's a little more complicated than doing a distal. Distal pancreatectomy still has a risk of leak from the cut edge of the pancreas, no matter what you do, whether you staple it or sew it. It's very common to have leaks, but those leaks will generally seal off. But with a Whipple, it's a little more involved. There's about a 3% risk of death. A lot of people have problems with delayed gastric emptying. Pancreatic leaks happen in about a third of the patients. Half of the patients will need a blood transfusion. About 10% will bleed postoperatively. Bile ducts and gastric leaks are pretty uncommon, but about 15% of patients will get readmitted for dehydration or failure to thrive. So again, these operations are not without their complications. So laparoscopically, you can resect PNETs, and this is especially good for distal lesions. You can also do enucleation through the laparoscope, and it's a very well-suited operation for distal pancreatectomy, splenectomy, and in some centers with significant expertise, laparoscopic Whipples are being done. This just shows the kind of port placement that we use. We usually put 2 10-12s and 3 5s. We'll get exposure something like this. You see us pulling the stomach up at the left and dissecting into the lesser sac. And then you mobilize the inferior border of the pancreas, find the splenic vein. And this just shows it intraoperatively with mobilization of the pancreas here. And then divide the pancreas proximal to the lesion with the splenic vein, splenic artery, and in this case, the IMV. Now, in many of these cases, you're gonna take the spleen, but it's not necessary to take the spleen. You can do a Warshaw-like procedure. This is what it's going to look like when you do take the spleen. And usually, that's not going to come out through a 10 to 12 port site, so you're going to have to make a little opening. And sometimes, if you know you're going to do that, you can put a hand port in there. Then sometimes that'll enhance your dissection. But you can do a Warshaw-like procedure by saving the short gastric vessels and dividing proximally on the splenic artery and vein, and then just making sure you don't go too far distal and you leave these vessels open to the stomach, and you can preserve the spleen that way. This just shows, again, a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. There's a normal pancreas here. You can just barely see the spleen here. You can see some varices over here. And again, this is a tumor that invades in the splenic vein, and we're going to resect the spleen in this case. Now, this is what we see on CAT scan. This is actually not the classical hyper-enhancing lesion that you expect to see. This is a little bit hypodense. You can see the liver lesions, though, on this coronal side are enhancing in this phase. But this is a pretty common scenario that we see. And this is what a DOTA PET scan looks like in this patient. You can see uptake in the pancreas here, in here, and then you can see uptake in the liver metastases. So the strategy for these patients, as Xavier was mentioning for small bowel, you need to think about whether you're going to do resection of these things as well if they present simultaneously. So it's a little bit more of a difficult decision in pancreas because the progression-free survival is a little bit shorter, but the overall survival is similar to SBNETs with metastatic disease. So when you have liver metastases, the decision to resect the primary depends upon the extent of disease. It also depends on, and what I mean by that is in the liver, and then it also depends on the resectability of the primary tumor. And you need to always consider the systemic options. The options that we have for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors is a little better than what we have for SBNETs, okay? So the chemotherapy with capecitabine, temozolomide works better in PNETs than SBNETs, and a recent trial has shown actually very good responses with that. And you could always consider peptide rate receptor therapy as well. But the other thing you have to consider if you do a Whipple in a biliary enteric anastomosis is whether it's safe to do ablation of liver metastases, because what you've done is you've made the bile ducts accessible to bacteria, and if you have dead areas of liver, that can increase your infection rate. So some people would suggest doing staged procedures. So we believe in cytoreduction of pancreas tumors, but it's a little more complex. The other thing that we have to talk about is what do you do when you have a high-grade tumors? Most small bowel tumors that Xavier talked about are well-differentiated and low-grade, but in pancreas, there's a significant number that are high-grade. And what we mean by high-grade is that the Ki-67 is over 20, or it's poorly differentiated. What that means is if you look at it under the microscope, there are small cells and large cells, and it doesn't look like it's going to behave nicely. And the problem with these patients is generally their survival is fairly short. And so it doesn't really matter what you do, but they're not gonna live a long time. They're very, they tend to be responsive to chemotherapy, but the chemotherapy response doesn't last very long. So you could consider resecting a high-grade tumor if there's no evidence of metastatic disease and if the tumor's been stable for some time, which is an uncommon situation. Or the Ki-67 is kind of at the lower end of that greater than 20 spectrum. I mean, if it's greater than 50, you probably shouldn't do it. If it's in the 20 to 30 range and there are no metastases or few metastases, it's something you might want to consider. So our overall strategy to PNETs is to remove the primary, resect the regional lymph nodes, do a cholecystectomy for the reasons that Xavier mentioned. And again, if the patient has a small tumor and they're not going to be on somatostatin analogs, it may not be that important. But if they are going to be on somatostatin analogs and you can do it, you should do it at the same time. And then if there are liver metastases, we tend to cytoreduce them. But again, it's a little more complicated situation. And then we use somatostatin analogs in patients with metastatic disease. And when patients progress, then we go to systemic therapy. There are exceptions to that. If somebody has a really large pancreatic head tumor that's unresectable, those are somebody we might give neoadjuvant therapy with capecitabine and temozolomide and see how they respond. But that's our general strategy.